Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
16-year-old college students? Absolutely.
I totally wish they would have done that when I was in high school. I hated high school. I was bored.
And here's an encouraging fact. In a recent study, early college high schools had a graduation rate of 92%. But these are schools where kids earn college credit while they're still in high school. What happens when they get that diploma and head out on their own?
High school is like the state of the nation. Some people never change after graduation.
I feel like there are a lot of programs to get these kids into college early, but I don't think that there's as many programs to support them once they finish. I think that the job market just isn't ready for these kids, and they're barely even ready for the kids that graduate at a regular age.
We all seem to have strong opinions on this issue, and it's all complicated by our memories of the prom. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, February 19th. I'm here with Todd Zwillick, who's filling in for John Hockenberry all this week. And the takeaway for me, Todd, is that there's some confusion over this because there's two different kinds of things people are talking about. The first thing we talked about yesterday was college credit for kids who are still in high school. That's not the same as kids who just graduate early and go to college.
And go to college with a bunch of kids who are older than they are, not to mention a lot of concerns that might be older if they're 16. Well, let's get some of the right to some of the top stories we're following this morning. 7 days in, the battle for Afghanistan. Marja, the Afghani state city of Marja, rages on. NATO says six service members were killed yesterday alone as U.S. and Afghan troops ran into snipers and well-fortified Taliban positions. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Dr. Nadir Adash, a former Afghan government official, who told us even if we run the Taliban out of Marja, they'll just turn up somewhere else.
Now we see an increase in the insurgency in the northern parts of Afghanistan, which was pretty stable before.
We're also getting new details about the arrest of the Afghan Taliban's military commander, Mullah Baradar. Our partner, The New York Times, is reporting Baradar was not the target of the raid in which he was captured. U.S. officials are calling it a lucky accident.
Here at home, 53-year-old Joe Stack left a note on his blog before slamming his small plane into an Austin, Texas office building yesterday. The blog post read, "Nothing changes unless there's a body count." Two bodies, one of which is believed to be Stack, were recovered from the building that housed IRS workers. And yesterday, we talked about a new initiative that gives high school students the option of placing out of their senior year and going straight to college. We have more in this story because we have such strong response from listeners. Valerie Perdue-Vons joins us. She's a professor of psychology at Columbia University. Valerie, is there a distinction between a student who's academically ready to leave high school and a student who is mature enough to deal with college?
Yeah, I think that there is. And I think that a lot of times people are taking not enough account of the psychological component. Academically, you can have the grades. You can even financially, your parents, it's a great opportunity to go on to community college. Emotionally, even financially, do you have a credit card? What is the college doing for you? What, you're taking a bus. Everyone else is driving. All these things create differences. The second thing is that people think of college as this wonderful place, but it's extremely isolating in your first year when you're trying to make friends. Who wants to be friends with a 16-year-old or a 15-year-old compared to particularly in community colleges where the average age of students are 20 and 21? Okay. So the gap is huge there.
Okay, we're going to talk more with Valerie Perdue-Vons in just a moment. Let's take a quick look at the markets. Futures are down right now. The Dow will start at 10,392. The S&P opens at 1,106 and the NASDAQ opens at 2,241. We're going to be talking about Malcolm X today. He was assassinated 45 years ago this weekend, and we'll be looking at his legacy.
We're also talking about movies this morning and getting wowed by movies that you never thought you'd like. What film did you think you would hate, and now it wound up being one of your favorites? 8778MYTAKE, of course, on the website. You can post at thetakeaway.org. Coming up next, we heard from so many of you about graduating from high school early to go to college. Some of you think it's good, some of you think it's bad. We'll learn more about what you said in just a few minutes.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headley here with Todd Zwillick. And we talked yesterday about a new initiative that gives high school students the option to place out of their senior year, sometimes even their junior year, and go straight on to college. This sparked a lively debate among our listeners.
This is Peter calling from Newton, Massachusetts. I know it had its ups and downs for me and for my own kids, but I don't think they should be encouraging kids to move on faster. There's a lot of growing up to do.
Heard from a lot of people who said they hated high school and would have liked to make it shorter, but is that a reason to move from high school to college? We've got the answers today from Joseph Harris. He's the director of the National High School Center, a research initiative that's funded by the U.S. Department of Education. And also Valerie Prettyvon rejoins us. She's a psychology professor at Columbia University. So, Joseph, let me start with you. This idea of moving on, or at least doing college coursework early, is not a new one. That's been around for a long time. I got a lot of college coursework done while I was in high school by taking AP tests and a couple college classes.
Yes, that is correct. In fact, it's been around probably for more than 20 years. My own son took college-level courses in the early 1980s.
But there's a distinction here because some of these programs are ones in which they stay in a high school setting and they get college credits. But then there's some people who are talking about just allowing kids to leave high school after their 10th grade year and move on to a community college. That's a different thing.
Well, there's actually a cross between the two. A very popular program over the last few years have been what are called middle college high schools or early college high schools, in which there are courses offered in a kind of a nested setting within a community college so that students are bused in and spend the day at the community college and then are bused back to their local high schools. So it's really not an either-or situation. There can be opportunities for students to take college-level courses on college campuses, and those have been around and have been tested over many years.
Here's my an issue that I have with this, and that's that the statistics tell us that half of kids in college change their majors, half of them, and 40% don't finish a degree by the time they've been in college for 6 years. So if we're talking about a period of a time of life where kids really are changing so rapidly that they're not going to be the same person at 16, 17, 18, that is, they are at 20, why should we be rushing them into it?
Well, I think, again, remembering this isn't not necessarily for every student that's out there. Some of the reasons that those kids take longer and take up to 6 years is that there's a growing number of students who are going into college that need some type of remediation to be brought up to speed to be able to do college-level courses. One of the things that's proposed in this new approach is the use of screening tests to make sure that kids have the college and career-ready skills before they even attempt to take a college-level course.
Okay, but that's not the reason why a lot of people say they want to go. This is one of our listeners who called from South Florida.
This is Eric calling from South Florida. I almost dropped out of high school in ninth grade because I wanted to get into college so badly. Luckily, in South Florida, they have this thing called the School for Advanced Studies that allows you to start college as part of dual enrollment half-time in 11th grade. And graduate with enough credits to have an associate's degree and then go on to regular college. So, yeah, I think it should be definitely an option nationwide.
Valerie Prettyvon, is it better in terms of a transition when we keep them within a high school setting and allow them to take advanced courses?
I think that there are clear psychological issues in terms of having a cohort of students. There's also the other issue. There's a great finding in psychology called the big fish in the little pond effect, showing that student achievement is better when you have students that are at the top of their class in a lower tier group than at the bottom of the class in a higher tier group. And there's clear evidence related to grades and so forth. So what I see in terms of that is, you know, really, I'm not clear about what the screening process is for these students who are going into the community college, but they're clearly going to be the ones that are the little fish in the big pond.
Well, you heard Joseph Harris talking about this has to be something that's individually evaluated. This is Shane.
I actually started taking some community college classes when I was 16, and I was able to finish a whole year ahead of all my other friends who went out to universities and everything. So I think it's great. It's a great program, but it all depends on the student and if they can handle it.
What kind of student, Valerie, would best benefit from something like this?
One of the things that I think would be great is not just one student, but a small cohort of students. So certainly these sort of small nested settings, but also two or three peers going together to take courses, I think, are better. Because, again, for college students, they don't necessarily want to befriend a high school student. So, you know, one is emotional maturity. Two are parents not thinking that their 16-year-old is really in college and they really have hands-off. They actually need to be more hands-on at that point. So I think it's really a dynamic between the parents and the student, and then also trying to get at least some kind of small cohort so these 16, 15-year-olds are not so isolated in community colleges.
Joseph Harris, for these students, when they actually end up in college, when they've left their advanced studies courses and are in a community college at the age of 16, what kind of structures do we need to have in place so that these kids don't get isolated, so that they're not dealing with 21-year-olds and having to deal with drinking and maybe get involved in sexual issues that they may have been possibly more protected from in high school?
Well, I think Valerie raises a good point. I think having ensuring there are cohort opportunity, you know, cohorts that students can be part of where they can identify with other students who are in similar situations is a good remedy to that problem.
Okay, I want to play one more clip from a listener. This is Mimi.
This is Mimi from Michigan, and I have a 16-year-old daughter who takes honors classes. She would be a wonderful candidate for entrance into early college. That's the only thing she doesn't really understand about high school is the hoopla about adolescence.
Valerie Purdy Vons, this raises an issue for me, which is that high school students are not always the best judges of how mature they are. Parents aren't always the best judges of whether their kid would get into trouble or what they can handle. And administrators are sometimes compromised because they're trying to save on their budgets. So who judges whether a student's ready academically and in maturity?
So this is a place where I think quite a bit of research needs to be done. I certainly think that there's a certain type of student that may benefit. Certainly students who are ostracized in high school may benefit. Certainly students who may be at risk and high school is not a great environment may benefit. But I certainly think, again, it's an interaction between the parents, the students, and creating some kind of cohort where they'll be safe in these community colleges. But certainly this is an area where more research needs to be done in terms of what kind of profile of student will benefit.
Okay, Valerie Purdy Vons is a professor of psychology at Columbia University, and Dr. Joseph Harris, both of them doctors, Joseph Harris is the director of the National High School Center, which is a federally funded technical assistance center out of D.C. Keep the conversation going. Our listeners have lots to say on this. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 877-78-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. And it's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
President Obama says he'll post his own proposals for health care reform on the White House website by Monday. Meanwhile, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says the widely reported spikes in insurance premiums just don't make sense to her.
To suggest that this is entirely in line with even health care costs, which clearly are still exceeding typical inflation costs, these profits are wildly excessive.
Meanwhile, Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda, says he will testify before Congress on his company's safety recalls. He's been invited by Congress to testify. That's as the Department of Transportation officially launches another investigation, this time into power steering on the Corolla.
In Haiti, the UN says it needs more money. It's asked for nearly $1.5 billion to help with relief efforts. That's more than double its initial request. And an update on the 8 American missionaries who were freed after being detained in Haiti on child kidnapping. One of their attorneys says his clients are unlikely to face any further charges. Two of the missionaries are still in jail in Haiti. And in Florida, Tiger Woods takes center stage today. He'll make his first public comment since his sex scandal broke on Thanksgiving. That's expected at 11 a.m. Eastern time. And finally, Australia has their first saint. The Pope will canonize Mother Mary MacKillop for her work with the needy. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we'll bring you the details from Austin, Texas, where a small plane crashed into a building that housed IRS workers. And we're also asking you today about your favorite movies that you thought you'd hate. Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment to thetakeaway.org. Did you expect to hate it and now it's one of your favorites? Let us know.
Titanic.
Hey, you want that to go?
Hey, Todd Zwillick here with Celeste. I'm filling in for John Hockenberry, of course. It's time for some takeouts on the stories we're following. First up,
It looked like the building exploding from the inside in a huge ball of fire. Debris was flying through the air. I was literally just mortified as I'm driving. I'm just looking at this building exploding.
That's Armando Gonzalez, a furniture salesman who witnessed the plane crash. Fellow Texan Joseph Andrew Stack allegedly flew a small plane into a building where the IRS houses about 200 workers. Joining us now with more is Ian Crawford, news editor for public radio station KUT in Austin, Texas. Ian, what is the latest information we have from the crash site there in Austin?
The latest thing we have, Todd, is that the FBI and the Austin Fire Department confirmed late last night that two bodies were found in the what was left of the Echelon building in northwest Austin. No IDs on the bodies yet. There had been two people reported missing earlier in the day, one a federal employee, the other the pilot. People are extrapolating that one of the bodies found was the pilot, but again, nothing has been confirmed by local authorities yet.
And Ian Crawford from Takeaway member station KUT in Austin. What do we know about Joseph Andrew Stack and reports of an alleged confession, a screed on his website? I heard one quote that said, "Nothing changes unless there's a body count."
That's right. There was we printed out the note before the note was taken down off the website at the request of the FBI. But one other quote that came from that, in fact, was in the opening line, was telling the IRS to take my pound of flesh and sleep well. It's a long rambling diatribe lambasting the government, apparently admitting that he used several thousands of dollars in arrears in taxes to the IRS. And he signed the note, Joe Stack, and then in parentheses, the dates 1956 to 2010.
And already questions, of course, about whether or not this constitutes an act of terrorism. Ian Crawford from Takeaway member station KUT in Austin, thanks so much.
For our next take, we'll go back to Vancouver. Jason Stallman joins us again. He's the Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times. Jason, what is going on this Friday? People say it's kind of a light Friday, but we're going to see a sport many people didn't even know existed. It's called skeleton. What is it?
Well, you know, every 2 years, the Olympics seems to offer an international audience some sports that you really don't pay attention to except for when the Olympics are on. And that's certainly what's happening now at the Whistler sliding track up at 2 hours away from Vancouver in the mountains. This is the facility that is home to bobsled, skeleton, and luge, the daredevil thrill-seeker sports where they fly down the mountain on an icy chute. And the reason it's so compelling right now is because, as everyone knows, a luge athlete from Georgia died last week on this track. So many athletes who compete here say it's too dangerous. The speeds they're attaining are just too high. So now the luge competition is over, and we turn to skeleton and bobsled. The first night of bobsled training, there were 8 crashes. Last night, there were at least 3 more. A Swiss rider and an Australian rider were hospitalized, and they were held out of practice yesterday. So oddly, all eyes at the Whistler sliding track right now on bobsled and skeleton.
And is this a higher number of injuries than in normal Olympics?
You know, the officials are saying that at least for that first night of training on bobsled, that the 8 crashes was not out of the ordinary. We haven't been able to corroborate that, but one thing is for sure, that the speeds that they're attaining on this track are much higher than other tracks. It was expected, at least for luge, that the athletes would reach about 140, 145 kilometers an hour. They were about 10 to 15 over that, so they're going much faster here.
And so you have to wonder if they're going to have some kind of meeting of the minds later to discuss whether or not something is too fast when you're heading down an icy track in the Olympics.
That's the big question moving forward, and are they going to wait until after the Olympics to address this, or are they going to do something during? The luge competition, the course was changed. They made it shorter to diminish the speeds. Bobsled and skeleton officials so far have said they're not going to alter their course, so we'll see if the crashes continue.
Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks, Jason.
For our last takeout now, we look back at the past 5 days with our friends from The Week magazine. Who had a good week and who had a bad week? First up, love really does stink, apparently, at least for one farm couple in Minnesota. For Valentine's Day, get this, wife Beth Andersland woke up to find a half-mile-wide heart drawn on her lawn in manure. Now, I know what you're she knows what you're thinking.
How can a design in a field made out of manure be anything special
but the manure is from cows, and I dearly love my cows, and manure is part of the package.
Beth says she loves her Valentine's Day gift, so what can we say except way to go, Mr. Andersland, for creativity. For that, you get the week's Good Week Award.
The Week magazine also has flying on their mind. Bad week for the cold. American Airlines announced it will now charge $8 for blankets. That's not the only reason it was a bad week for airline passengers. In our minds, we're thinking this week wasn't that great to be director Kevin Smith or Southwest Airlines.
I live my life fat, and I have to navigate through a thin person's world all the time. And as such, you would never put yourself into harm's way, so to speak, in regards to your girth or size.
That is director Kevin Smith on his podcast talking about Southwest Airlines. They booted him off a flight on Saturday since Smith wasn't able to, quote, comfortably lower the armrest, end quote. Because of his size, Southwest took him off the flight.
I guess that's the standard, but not a good week then for bigger people flying or for Southwest Airlines facing all the bad PR over this. But that's a good week. That's a good week and a bad week. What are your suggestions?
I'm Veronica from Oklahoma City, and I nominate my husband for the worst week. He's been unemployed since July and was working towards a job that he really wanted and did not get it after 4 months of process. I vote my husband.
Definitely a bad week for him, Veronica. Don't give up. Give us your suggestions from news or from your life. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to the site at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, since the start of the Afghan war, the U.S. has been trying to gain control of the country dominated by the Taliban. How well do we really understand our enemy? More on that in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here. I'm filling in for John Hockenberry this week, and I'm here with Celeste. Coming up, the war with the Taliban rages on, but how well do we really understand our enemies? We talk more about that in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on some top stories that we're following at 31 minutes after the hour. President Obama is sending $1.5 billion to the five states hit hardest by the housing crisis. Those five are Arizona, California, Michigan, Florida, and Nevada. They've seen their home prices drop by 20% or more. The president will make the announcement in Las Vegas later this morning. The president did announce a $1.25 billion settlement with a group of black farmers over a civil rights case that's been around for decades. The farmers say the Agriculture Department discriminated against them for years by slow-peddling loan applications, leaving them unable to plant certain crops.
We're getting word this morning that the Afghan Taliban's second-in-command, Mullah Baradar, and two other high-value militants may get deported to Afghanistan, but they will not be turned over to U.S. custody. Pakistan's interior minister says that the militants have not committed any crimes in Pakistan. They will not remain in the country. Our partner, the New York Times, is reporting Mullah Baradar was not the target in the raid in which he was captured. Officials are calling it a lucky accident. Here at home, for the first time in its history, Walmart sales are down. The world's largest retail chain posted a 0.5% decline last quarter. Walmart still had over $70 billion in U.S. sales, though. And the Federal Reserve has decided to boost the rate banks pay for emergency loans. That move won't directly affect borrowing costs for Americans, only banks. It goes into effect today. Taking a look at the markets, Asian and European markets are down, as are futures. The Dow will start at 10,392. The S&P opens at 1,106, and the NASDAQ starts at 2,241. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Since the start of the Afghan war in Afghanistan in 2001, the U.S. has been trying to gain control of a country ruled and dominated by the Taliban. And with the fighting this week in Marja, our focus is more than ever on pushing the Taliban out.
The Taliban is clearly being squeezed. Being squeezed by our forces, coalition forces, Afghan forces in Afghanistan, being squeezed by Pakistani military and intelligence forces.
That's Pentagon spokesman Jeff Morrell trying to deliver some good news for the American military on the issue of the Taliban in Marja. But while the fighting is going on, how well do we really understand our enemies? And if we don't know what they want and how they're motivated, can we ever really be successful in Afghanistan? Joining us to talk about that is Alex Strick Van Linshoten, a researcher who lives in Kandahar, Afghanistan. And he and his partner translated a book called My Life with the Taliban, the autobiography of a senior member of Afghanistan's Taliban. Welcome.
Good morning.
Now, your book was written by a gentleman named Mullah Abdul Salim Zahif, and he's a former senior member of the Taliban. It was originally written in Pashtun. You did a cultural translation, not a direct translation of this book, after hours, dozens, if not hundreds of hours of interviews, if I'm not mistaken. What After all of these interviews, what do you think we need to know first and foremost about the Taliban?
I mean, the first thing, I guess, is that the Taliban are a very different group of people, and certainly this idea of understanding and our lack of understanding is pretty important. You know, we're 9 years into a conflict, and some of the very basic things about the people in southern Afghanistan we still have very little idea about.
What do you think that we're missing primarily? If there's a couple of things about the Taliban that we are missing that you think might be impeding our progress there in winning over the people who they say they're fighting for?
In terms of the Taliban movement, one important thing is the strong local basis to the movement. Often when we talk about the Taliban, people want to say that it's fueled by Pakistan, it's an outside creation, these outsiders from the Afghan country, whereas in fact it's not. It was a local movement in inception. It has a very long history, particularly in the 1980s war against the Soviet Union. And we have to remember all of these kind of very local and indigenous elements to the Taliban movement, particularly when we're talking about southern Afghanistan.
So the fact that they're homegrown, truly a grassroots movement, even if we don't want to believe it, they are a grassroots group in Afghanistan. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And this goes to then this discussion which we have at the moment about whether we should be talking with the Taliban.
Right.
If we assume that they're a foreign movement, then perhaps we don't need to, because, you know, it's just a question of expelling them out of the country. But given that there's such a strong local basis for these people, that feeds into that discussion.
Well, you mentioned whether we should be talking to them, and that's an issue that's going to come up. There are apparently talks been going on between the Taliban and the Afghan government in the Maldives. That's what we understand this week. But as we decide whether we negotiate with them or not, are the Taliban people who would negotiate with us? You know, we make this distinction, or we should anyway, between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, we say we're going to capture or kill. The Taliban different? What would we think if we found them across the table from us?
Sitting across the table from you is quite a different experience from talking about negotiations between groups on a one-on-one basis. As I discovered while writing this book, you can have perfectly fine relationships and trust and so on, but in terms of movement, in terms of what the Taliban think, they don't really feel that they can trust either the foreigners or the Afghan government itself. The Afghan government isn't seen as a legitimate negotiating partner by the Taliban.
Does that mean that any endgame is useless? I mean, if they have no inherent trust for the Afghan government or for us, that might mean that they choose just to fight to the death. I don't know if I'm reading too much into it.
There's certainly an element of that, but Afghans have always been very pragmatic people, and in the end, the solution which we're going to have in Afghanistan is a political solution. It's not a military solution.
You know, Todd's alluded to this. Very often Americans make the mistake of lumping the Taliban together with Al-Qaeda fighters and thinking of them both as terrorist groups. But there's very different motivations for these true groups, right? What pushes the Taliban to keep fighting?
The Taliban, I mean, it's we use one word for it, but it's a group with an incredibly diverse background of people. You have some people who are fighting for ideological reasons, maybe who are closer to what we call Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. We have other people who are fighting because out of economic reasons. You have other people who are fighting simply because for the kind of camaraderie of the trench and because they're young and bored and in the villages. You have people who are forced out and alienated by the local government, which is quite predatory.
And religious reasons too.
Yes, I mean that goes to the kind of ideological thing. But I think we tend in the West to overplay the religious element. For the Taliban, it's they talk a lot about religion, but once you look a bit beyond that, it's not so important as a motivating factor.
So, Alex Strick Van Linshoten, I'm interested in your prognosis, knowing what you know about the people in Afghanistan, let's say in Marja, but across Afghanistan more broadly, and what you know about the enemy, in this case, the Taliban. What's your prognosis for this 9-year effort so far?
So far, I mean, we are where we are. We've been trying.
Where are we going, I guess, is my question.
We're looking at more of the same, I have to say. The things that need to change in terms of a wider strategy, I don't think we've seen that that top level change yet.
What about Stanley McChrystal's schools in a box, government in a box, get the Taliban out, put civil and social institutions in? Does that have any traction from what you know about the Taliban and the Afghans?
Possibly, but our fundamental problem is that we're working together with the Afghan government, who have very little legitimacy in the eyes of the Afghan people. And every time we go into a place and then we put the Afghan government there, the government are going to mess it up, more or less.
And without a measure of credibility or respect from the people on the ground, it seems to be that you're saying that our efforts there could come to naught unless that respect is somehow gained. It all seems very, very complicated, but we're grateful for your insights. That's Alex Strick Van Linshoten, a researcher who lives in Kandahar and has helped translate and helped write a book, My Life with the Taliban. It's the autobiography of a senior member of Afghanistan's Taliban, and his insights have been very valuable. Alex, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. The assassination of a Hamas official, Mahmoud al-Mahou, last month in a Dubai hotel room has been compared to the plot of a cheap spy novel, with the cast of suspects who were klutzy, if nothing else, forged passports, fake beards, fake mustaches, floppy hats. So as the investigation of Mahou's murder reveals more and more real-life espionage clichés, we're consulting an expert in spy plots, fictional ones anyway, to discuss the literary merits of the crime. Novelist Olin Steinhauer joins us today. Olin's written six thrillers, including The Tourist. It's out in paperback this week. Good morning, Olin.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. You know, I've heard newscasters even saying that if this plot were used in a modern spy novel, it would be criticized as cliché and totally unbelievable. What do you think?
Well, I was looking at it when it first came out. A friend of mine, Kevin Wignall, directed my attention to it, and my thought was actually it would be brilliant. But if it's not Mossad, in spy fiction, things are seldom as straightforward as they seem in the news. And in this case, it would be much more interesting if, say, it was Hamas doing the hit because of some internal power struggle. Make it look like Mossad did it. And they save face while getting rid of someone, and they know Mossad's never going to say they didn't do it.
So the classic bait and switch there. But, we know lots about, bank robberies or casino robberies that involve a large group of guys. But would you ever plot 11 men to commit a murder?
Well, I think in reality, as opposed to spy fiction, it takes a few more people than you naturally think to get rid of someone. In this case, they had different people taking care of getting the keys, setting up the surveillance. And, before the age of satellites, you would regularly have a very large team just to follow one person so that no one noticed they were being followed.
So you're actually writing your next novel right now.
Yes, I am.
And you've already written about a murder in a hotel room. What would you borrow from this case? Is there anything you would take away?
Well, that's what I've been trying to think about. I wake up early to write, and this has been moving around in my head. And I like the idea of it being so many people, because that's not the sort of thing you would see in fiction. I think probably I am going to take a few details from it. I like the fact that the security cameras watch them go in the room and then appear again a while later. That's sort of a nicely cinematic thing that I think would work really well in a novel as well.
What would you not take? The floppy hat?
The floppy hats. I don't know about those. I mean, the thing that's strange to me about that is that I see these, and we have pretty clear pictures of their faces. I don't know what that was really supposed to accomplish.
I guess nobody really knows. Olin Steinhauer, author of The Tourist and five other thrillers, maybe a floppy hat appearing in a thriller on bookshelves now. He's author of The Tourist. It appears in paperback this week. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee. I'm here with Todd Zwillick, who is filling in for John Hockenberry. Coming up, Malcolm X was assassinated 45 years ago this Sunday, and we have a rediscovered interview with Malcolm X that hasn't been heard since the 1960s. We're going to be talking about his legacy in just a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. NATO forces in Afghanistan say six of their soldiers were killed yesterday in the fight to take the city of Marja. Meanwhile, the Afghan defense minister, General Rahim Wardek, tells our partner, the BBC, they're almost done clearing the Taliban out of the city. He says Afghan forces are taking the lead.
Physically on the battlefield, we are ahead of the Allied forces in the operation.
In Iraq, the U.S. military mission will soon get a new name. As of September, Operation Iraqi Freedom will be called Operation New Dawn. The military says it will send a strong signal that Iraq is being returned to the Iraqi people.
At home now, President Obama continues pushing health care. He says he'll post his own proposals for health care reform on the White House website by Monday. In Vancouver yesterday, the U.S. took four more medals, including a gold medal in men's figure skating, two in ladies snowboarding, and one in ladies alpine skiing. Finally, actress Katherine Grayson has died at the age of 88. This is her singing one of her most popular tunes from the 1952 musical, Lovely to Look At.
They asked me how I knew my true love was true.
Grayson appeared in many musicals during the 40s and the 50s, including Showboat and Kiss Me, Kate. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
45 years ago this weekend, civil rights leader Malcolm X was assassinated. And just a few months ago, our home station WNYC Radio unearthed tape of Malcolm X speaking in an interview in the early 1960s with WNYC journalist Eleanor Fisher. On this somber anniversary, we want to consider Malcolm X's legacy, not just through this rediscovered tape, but through two people whose lives were profoundly affected by him. Earl Grant was a close associate of Malcolm X and one of the last people to see him alive. Peter Bailey is a former associate editor for Ebony Magazine and an original member of Malcolm X's Organization of Afro-American Unity. Mr. Grant, let's start with the big question that I guess a lot of people ask now is what do you think is the legacy of Malcolm X?
Well, he was primarily concerned about seeing the world the way it actually is, not the way people believe in it. And he stressed all the time that we have to be informed about whatever we're doing. He told us there'd never been an ignorant revolution, and there never would be one. It's always about information.
Which has ended up to being frighteningly accurate. You know, I was not alive during Malcolm X's lifetime. All I know of him is what I've read in books, my history texts. I'm wondering if you can kind of flesh out his biography for me. I mean, what kind of a person was he?
Well, he was like your vision of a grandfather, very sweet, loving person. He wasn't always this person with his fists clenched and his teeth showing. That's the image that the press presented of him. But there were other images of him they never did try to present.
Peter Bailey, you weren't a close associate of Malcolm X, but you've called him your master teacher. What do you mean by that? What did you learn from him?
He provided me with a perspective on how to view the country and the world. That was his most important thing to me. He also taught me how to use language. I described 1964, the policeman who killed that young boy, as a murderer. And he told me, no, you can't use a murderer, because those are legal terms. Call him a killer and refer to it as a killing, because it's a killing, and he's a killer, and it's a killing no matter what the circumstances. And that policeman later sued SCLC and CORE. So it was those kinds of things, how to look at the world. I'm a journalist because of him. He stressed the importance of the gathering and distribution of information and led me into journalism. I had never even thought about journalism until I got involved with him.
I want to play you a clip from an interview he did with WNYC reporter Eleanor Fleischer in the early 1960s, kind of giving us insight into how he framed his ideas.
You think the Negro has first to raise himself to a status of equality with the white community.
Yes.
Now, what happens, assuming that he can do that, would you then be in favor of integration, let's say, in the schools or anyplace else?
When you are equal with another person, the problem of integration doesn't even arise. The only minority in America that's asking for integration is the so-called Negro, primarily because he is inferior, not inherently inferior, but he's economically, socially, politically inferior, and this exists because He has never tried to stand on his own two feet and do something for himself. He has filled the role of a beggar.
Mr. Grant, first of all, the power of hearing his voice is amazing. After 45 years, even longer, this was done in the early 1960s. But he never shied away from these very controversial stances.
No, one of his favorite statements was, "Tell it like it is." He lived in a real world at all times. He says, "Brother, no matter how much time you stand around hallucinating, reality is all around you."
You know, we now celebrate civil rights through Martin Luther King Day, and we actually have a piece of tape from this interview in which Malcolm X was talking about Martin Luther King.
Martin Luther King has made the Negro in America unnatural. He has taken away from the Negro his God-given right to defend himself. He has them going through. I looked on the television the other night and saw them beating a Negro unmercifully in Mississippi. And this is the result of a brainwashing technique that a certain power structure in the American government has paid these Negro integrationist leaders to perpetuate among our people.
Such a passionate man. And Peter, I'm wondering, you know, too often now Martin Luther King is seen as the symbol for the entire civil rights movement, but Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were both working toward the same goal in very different ways.
I think you have to understand that during the latter year, during the time that I was involved with Brother Malcolm, he had his relationship with Dr. King had improved considerably.
Come full circle.
Had improved considerably, and he respected Dr. King. I don't know if they ever would have been bosom buddies, but I think they had developed a tremendous amount of respect for each other. In fact, in Anthony Summers' book on J. Edgar Hoover, there's a quote by J. Edgar Hoover in which he is speaking to then-Senator Lyndon Johnson, and he says, if we could get those two guys fighting each other to kill one another off. And the two guys he was talking about was Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. So, you know, J. Edgar Hoover recognized that a combination of these two men working together could have caused him some nightmares. And so I think that what he said about Dr. King at that time, because he believed in self-defense. That's what he was really saying. I tell people all the time, if you ever find a thing where Brother Malcolm advocated black people going out and shooting people, that's not true. It was always in the context of self-defense. And he believed in that. He believed strongly that people had a right to defend themselves. And if you read Martin Luther King's book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos, Our Community, you'll see a different Martin Luther King than the I Have a Dream that he's been reduced to.
They both changed.
Yes.
Earl Grant, I'm wondering, do we have, as we look at our textbooks today, are we seeing the civil rights movement through maybe simplistic eyes? We're not seeing all these variations of opinion and debate?
I think you certainly are. What Malcolm was always trying to do was to get us to, if you're born in this country, grew up in this country, how come you don't think like an American? And Americans don't do any of that nonviolent stuff. That's not this country. So how could you have been in this country, learned about Washington, Patrick Henry? They taught me all this stuff in school. And then you come out and stand on the corner and talk about you're nonviolent. Doesn't make sense. That's unnatural.
And that's what he was talking about in that particular clip.
Yeah.
And we have one more clip for you.
He's already separate. The fact that he's a second-class citizen is a political separation. The fact that he's the last hired and the first fired is an economic separation. Only in this form of separation, the black man is exploited.
In the last minute here, Peter Bailey, that separation he's talking about for the black man, it still hasn't been fixed.
Yes, I mean, he was basically saying that separation. Brother Malcolm was a very, very intelligent person. So he would not take positions that were ludicrous. He meant that if you separate yourself to build yourself up, doesn't mean you escape from the world. You know, people, they try to present it as though he was saying we could somehow escape from the world. But he was not. And when you hear him speak, you have to put it in the context of the times, 1955, 1965, the height of the civil rights movement. What happened during that time? Emmett Till was lynched. The little girls were killed in Birmingham. Medgar Evers was assassinated. I mean, that was terrorism in this country at that time. And his speeches and things were responding to rampant, unpunished, and that's the key word, unpunished terrorism. terrorism.
Peter Bailey, former associate editor of Ebony Magazine and original member of the Organization for Afro-American Unity, and Earl Grant, close associate of Malcolm X, one of the last to see him alive. You can hear the entire historic interview on our website, thetakeaway.org.
While you're there, we have a special feature on Malcolm X. You should go there to listen, of course, to the interview that Celeste just mentioned, and leave any of your comments at thetakeaway.org, because as always, we want to hear from you. You can also call 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.